Okay, thank you everyone for coming this evening. We are going to be doing a very different kind of series, at least the launch point. What we are ultimately going to be doing over the next few weeks is having some really interesting discussions around some of the classic questions about Hanukkah. But what's going to get us there is what I think is one of the more interesting hooks, one of the more interesting springboards possible. And that is a US Supreme Court case in 1989. And the town of Allegheny in just outside of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania had two different religious displays on government property. One of which, not interesting to us, but was a nativity scene with an explicit Christian message on the courthouse. And the second was an 18-foot high menorah that was outside the city council building next to a 45-foot high Christmas tree. And in a shocking turn of events, this will surprise everyone. The 18-foot menorah came from Chabad, but it was kind of put up, stored by the city. And basically, what happened was the ACLU sued, claiming that the menorah and the nativity scene violated the Establishment Clause. The government cannot endorse religious worship, and so you have both an explicit Christian symbol and explicit Jewish symbol being endorsed by government. That was their claim, and it made its way to the Supreme Court. So, in a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court declared that the nativity scene had to be taken down. But the menorah could stay up. And what is of completely non-interest to us are the four justices who disagreed. They thought neither was a problem. And that's all to do with their legal opinions on how they understood the Establishment Clause. What is interesting are the five justices, really four of them, who believed that the menorah could stay up, even though the nativity scene had to go down. And that's Justice Blackmun, O'Connor, Stevens, Brenner, and Marshall was the fifth, but again, we're less interested in him. And basically, what ended up happening when you read the Supreme Court opinion from all these justices, and what makes it so fascinating is what you end up reading is the Supreme Court justices debating the meaning of Hanukkah. And so, what we are going to do, beginning with, and in a second, I'll share the source sheet. But what we are going to be doing is by looking at, by using the Supreme Court opinion as a launch point, it's going to allow us to discuss three central questions regarding Hanukkah. The first of which, what we will talk about tonight, is one of the classic questions. My Hanukkah, what exactly is Hanukkah? What are we celebrating? What's its purpose? The second question, which we'll talk about next week, what is the purpose of the menorah? In truth, this is the question the Supreme Court justices themselves were most interested in debating. And obviously, what we talk about tonight, the meaning of Hanukkah, the purpose of Hanukkah, will have an impact on the role the menorah plays in that. And then in the third week, which will take us right up to the week before Hanukkah, we'll ask a slightly different question, which is also a very important question that we don't maybe talk about too much nowadays. But in the 21st century, in 21st century America, Hanukkah is often perceived as both within the Jewish world and beyond the Jewish world as Jewish Christmas. And it's an interesting topic to explore in a couple of different ways. How should we encourage the celebration of Hanukkah in the 21st century, given that we live in a society with a very dominant holiday of its own time that also generally coincides with the same time of Hanukkah. But tonight we will focus on the classic question of my Hanukkah. But before we go any further, and in a second again, I'll share the source sheet, what I want to stress is this isn't law school. So we're not really going to be analyzing the Supreme Court justices' opinions for their legal value. I don't have much to offer on the legal validity, how good these arguments are by various Supreme Court justices. But what we're essentially going to use them for is to question their halachic value. As Jews, how well do the justices capture what is for us, some central themes of Hanukkah? And so with that, I'm going to share the screen. And I'm going to, everyone will see in just a second, the source sheet. And we're going to begin with a very lengthy quote from the Epistle. So Justice Blackmun, and again, I apologize in advance for not being completely familiar with the technical terms for various Supreme Court justice things, but he wrote the main opinion, his opinion, even though the others who agreed with him wrote alternative opinions. This was like the main opinion. This is the official kind of, you know how it works. Everyone else knows how it works. The Supreme Court justices, they might disagree with one another on details, but there's always one who writes the main opinion. He wrote the main opinion. And so I do want to read it through in just a second. One thing you will notice, by the way, if you are an eagle-eyed, attention to detail kind of person, you'll notice the typeface, the font, for the Supreme Court justices is going to be different than the one I usually use. And that's because, famously, all Supreme Court opinions are printed in Century Schoolbook, which is a font everyone has on their computer. And so I thought it would be cute to reproduce on the source sheet too, the Supreme Court justices' opinions in Century Schoolbook. So that's what we are reading. But straight away, let's just begin with source number one, and that will lead us into what we're going to be discussing tonight. So Justice Harry Blackmun writes the following. At least since 1982, the city has expanded its Grant Street holiday display to include a symbolic representation of Hanukkah, an eight-day Jewish holiday that begins on the 25th day of the Jewish lunar month of Kislev. I should point out before we go any further two observations. First, this is cool that a Supreme Court justice is writing the history of Hanukkah in his opinion. Second, obviously, he is not dealing with any primary sources. What I took out of this source sheet are the footnotes, the references. He is citing secondary literature. So, you know, let's be honest, some sort of, you know, aide found him a book that discusses Hanukkah, and now he's read that book, and now he's, you know, typing up what he's reading from that book. But nonetheless, it's very cool. We continue after the ellipses on the third line. According to Jewish tradition, on the 25th of Kislev in 164 BCE, the Maccabees rededicated the Temple of Jerusalem after recapturing it from the Greeks, or more accurately, from the Greek-influenced Seleucid Empire in the course of a political rebellion. Yes, by the way, just a side point, not for now, it was they weren't Greek, they were Seleucids. They just, you know, much as in the same way one would use the term Western, but one would divide all the various Western countries to be different people. So to think of Greek here in the same term as Westerners in the cultural sense, as opposed to they didn't actually come from Greece. Anyway, Hanukkah is the holiday, second paragraph, which celebrates that event. The Talmud explains the lamp lighting ritual as a commemoration of an event that occurred during the rededication of the temple. The temple housed a seven-branch menorah, which was to be kept burning continuously. When the Maccabees rededicated the temple, they had only enough oil to last for one day. But according to the Talmud, the oil miraculously lasted for 8 days, the length of time it took to obtain additional oil. To celebrate and publicly proclaim this miracle, the Talmud prescribes that it is a mitzvah, a commandment, for Jews to place a lamp with eight lights just outside the entrance to their homes or in a front window during the 8 days of Hanukkah. Boy, is he thorough. We continue after ellipses. And I'm gonna click the word just so it highlights. The Talmud also ordains certain blessings to be recited each night of Hanukkah before lighting the lamp. Although Jewish law does not contain any rule regarding the shape or substance of a Hanukkah lamp, it became customary to evoke the memory of the Temple menorah. The Temple menorah was of a tree and branch design. It had a central candlestick with six branches. In contrast, a Hanukkah menorah of tree and branch design has eight branches, one for each day of the holiday, plus a ninth to hold the shamash. Also, in contrast to the temple menorah, the Hanukkah menorah is not a sanctified object. It need not be treated with special care. That is a surprisingly thorough, and I would bet, again, you know, Justice Blackmun has someone else doing the hard work for him. But if we asked most Jews who are used to observing Hanukkah, you know, every single year to give a brief, you know, couple of paragraphs on Hanukkah, some of the details would be missed that Justice Blackmun got. But what Justice Blackmun captures very well, first of all, is the famous story of Hanukkah, the miracle of the oil, the primary source of which he quotes as the Talmud, but is actually, to be more precise, the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, source number two, which asks the following. My Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? The Tanu Rabbanan, we learn, B'chav hei b'kislev, the 25th of Kislev, Yomei de Chanukah, at Tamanya Ne'inun, they're the days of Chanukah, there's eight of them. Delola mispad bahon, or delola hit anot bahon, you cannot fast on them, you cannot eulogize on them, they are days of joy. She'nichnasu yevanim leheichal, when the Greeks entered the temple, timu kol hashmanim shebeheichal, they defiled all the oils that were in the sanctuary. Uchshe gavra malchut beit chashmonai, v'nitzchum, when the Hasmonean monarchy overcame them, they won. Badku v'lomatsu elapach echad shel shemen, they only found one cruse of oil. Shehaya munach b'chotamo shel kohen gadol, with the seal of the high priest. V'lo hayavo ela lahadlik yom echad, they could only light for one day. Na'asabo nes v'hidliku mimenu shmona yamin, but there was a miracle, it stayed lit for 8 days. L'shana acheret kva'um v'asa'um yamin tovim b'halal v'hoda'a. And therefore they instituted from that day forward, there would always be this holiday for halal, for thanksgiving of God, for this miracle, for these brachot. That is the story of Chanukah, the miracle of the oil. Frank, you have a question?
Yeah, they said that you cannot eulogize during the holiday. What happens? Can you, I mean, somebody dies. Can that person not be, their memory not be eulogized at the funeral?
So in short, there are a surprisingly large number of days. So it's a great question. There are a surprisingly large number of days in the Jewish year where eulogizing is forbidden. So there are several different approaches that you would sometimes find if you're at a funeral. One will be a shift in the focus. So you're not so much, the classic eulogy is intentionally depressing, as opposed to the celebration of the life of the person who has passed. So it's a very detailed and complicated practical halachic topic about what you do at a funeral during one of these times when you cannot eulogize. Practically speaking, distinctions are kind of made between the different forms that what we would call a eulogy would take. But the technical definition here, we're just going to assume, is dirge, depressing. The goal is to make you cry, as opposed to a celebration of someone's life where the goal is to make you reflect in more positive ways on the person who's passed, if that makes sense. But it's a much more detailed topic we can discuss at another time. But what we see in source number two is the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat describing, again, at this point, we've not seen anything unfamiliar. We've not seen anything new. This is the famous story of the miracle of Chanukah. And this is what Justice Blackmun is referencing. But there are actually two other themes of Chanukah that we tend to focus far less on. We tend to assume that there is one miracle, there is one event that is being celebrated on Chanukah, the oil that lasted 8 days, when in fact there are two other, very clear, and they're all related to one another, but two very clear miracles, additional miracles that took place, and two other reasons to celebrate that are related to Chanukah. The first, which Justice Blackmun himself notes, is the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash. So if you take a look at source number three, and the truth is the Book of Maccabees was not written originally in Hebrew. This is from Sfaria, where the Hebrew, you know, translation is as authentic as the English translation. They're both translations. But what you see in source number three, I'll just read the English, the Book of Maccabees. For those of you who are unfamiliar, I should just stress, the Book of Maccabees is part of what we would call the Apocrypha, which is those books that did not make it into Tanakh. They were not canonized. They are not part of the Hebrew Bible, but they were nonetheless written during the period primarily of Bayit Sheni, of the Second Temple period. So, and it's a whole fascinating topic for another time, but there were actually multiple quote-unquote biblical books written, celebrating, commemorating the events of Chanukah, describing the events of Chanukah, and those are found in the Book of Maccabees. And so that is what we are reading in sources 3 and 3a, which is, again, now is not the time to talk about the Book of Maccabees in any detail, but we will assume it is a valid historical account of the events that took place. And what it says in source number 3 is that Yehuda, the leader of the Hashmonaim, and his brothers and all the community of Israel commanded to celebrate the dedication of the altar, Chanukat HaMizbeach, on the 25th of the month of Kislev, 8 days each year with praise and thanksgiving to God. When you actually think about the most important event to happen on Hanukkah, and I wrote about this in my spotlight little thing that, you know, you would have been sent spotlight through email if you're a member of the shul and whatnot. The Chanukat HaMizbeach is the rededication of the altar. What we're really celebrating on Hanukkah is the fact that Jews once again had access to worship in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. During the time of the Seleucid rule, during Antiochus's power, the Jews didn't have the opportunity to worship God in the temple. Now, once again, they are free. They have broken away from, they have repelled the oppressive regime of the Seleucids. And now, once again, they can go back and worship proudly in the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, they rededicate. They have a Chanukat HaMizbeach in order to celebrate. And therefore, the holiday is actually celebrating that rededication every single year. Why 8 days? This is, I think, one of the most fascinating little pieces of history, which is a much larger point for another time. You may recall, you may have learned, I may have mentioned in other shiurim, that the way the Jewish calendar used to work was that it revolved around sightings of the moon. You knew what month it was based on whether witnesses testified to having seen the new moon. That was how Rosh Chodesh used to work and all those sorts of things. As you can imagine, during a war, it becomes very hard to keep track of the months. The calendar becomes very messed up when you're requiring eyewitness accounts and you're requiring safe passage for people to travel in order to testify, all of these various things. And so what they believed to be the 25th of Kislev was actually the 25th of Tishrei. They were off by a couple of months. Tishrei is obviously the month of Rosh Hashanah, of Yom Kippur, of Sukkot. And so this makes source 3a far more significant when you recognize that the first thing the Chashmonaim might have realized upon getting into the Beit HaMikdash was that it was actually basically Sukkot time. And so take a look at source number 3a. They celebrated a festival to God for 8 days, Kimei Chag HaSukkot, like the festival of Sukkot. Remembering how a short time before they had spent the festival of Sukkot like wild beasts in the mountains and the caves, what they had thought also was Sukkot at the time, they weren't able to celebrate Sukkot because it was wartime. And therefore, what do? They take willows and branches and offered songs of praise and thanksgiving to God, who had given them the strength and salvation to purify his temple. And then they decreed a rule in all the cities of Yehuda in the entire kingdom to celebrate this festival annually. This is an aspect of Hanukkah we focus far less on, but it's essentially Sukkot 2.0. The reason it's 8 days long is because Sukkot in the land of Israel is 8 days long, and because they had previously been unable to celebrate Chag HaSukkot, this was their first opportunity. Even though, fine, Yom Kippur is temple-centric, and Rosh Hashanah is temple-centric, Chag HaSukkot is the first of the pilgrimage festivals. It's the first of the Beit HaMikdash super-centric holidays. And so the first thing they did upon entering the Beit HaMikdash was that they celebrated Sukkot. They finally had a chance to celebrate their festival, and that's what they did. And they picked up their Arba Minim, they picked up their four species, and they celebrated. And it's important to think, Sukkot is primarily categorized as a Chag of Hallel, or a major component is thanksgiving to God, praise to God, which is also one of the major themes of Hanukkah. There is a surprising amount of overlap between the two festivals, and that's by design. That's by intent. You can make that argument based on the Book of Maccabees. So we've seen thus far two different reasons why you'd celebrate Hanukkah. Number one, the famous miracle of oil, as related in the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. Number two, the rededication of the temple. The first opportunity the Jewish people had once again to worship in the Beit HaMikdash. And that's a much more historical, you know, grounded in the, you know, historical experience of after the war. And there's a third reason, and this is a really, really well-known reason, but we tend to not fold it into our celebration of Hanukkah in the same way. And that is the military victory of the Hashmonaim. If you look at source number 4, this is something when it comes to Hanukkah, we will be saying so often. By the end, we will have told ourselves, we know it off by heart. We will no longer look in the Siddur to say it. And what that will actually mean is that we miss saying half of it every single time. But you say it enough and it starts to become very familiar. In the days of Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, the Hasmonean and his sons, when the wicked Greek kingdom rose up against your people, to make them forget your Torah, to stray from your laws, but you in your great mercy, you stood by them in their time of need, you fought their fight, judged their cause, avenged them with vengeance. Misarta giborim biad chalashim, you delivered the strong into the hands of the weak. Barabim biad miatim, you delivered the many into the hands of the few. Utmeim biad tahorim, the impure into the hands of the pure. Urshaim biad sadikim, the wicked into the hands of the righteous. Vezedim biad oiskei toiratacha, and the arrogant in the hands of those who learn Torah. Ulecha asita shem gadol v'kadosh be'olamecha, for you made yourself a great name, a holy name in the world, olamcha Yisrael, and for your people, asita teshua gadola, you made a great salvation, ufurkan kayom hazah, a great deliverance to this day. Va'acher kein bal v'anecha l'dir beitecha, they entered the temple, ufinu et heichalecha, cleansed it, v'tiharu et mikdashecha, purified it, v'hidlik neirot b'chatzot kodshecha, they kindled the light once again in your holy court. V'kavu shmanat yimei chanukah elu, and they instituted these days, lahodot o lahalil shimcha l'gadol, for thanksgiving, for praise to your great name. War, military victory. What we are actually celebrating on Hanukkah, we say in Al Hanisim, every single day of Hanukkah, we are celebrating V'rabim biad ma'atim, the many into the hands of the few. An unlikely military victory by a far inferior group of people, a guerrilla warfare, who were victorious against a mighty army, the Seleucid army. They conquered everything. They were very, very powerful, and yet they were repelled by those who lived in the land of Israel. This is the third reason, this unlikely military victory, this incredible moment, militaristically speaking. That's the other miracle. So we have three: miracle of oil, rededication of the temple, and the war. Now, obviously, you can tell a story where all three of these fit. First, they won the war. That's miracle number one. Then it's unclear which would come first. They rededicate the temple. And now that they've rededicated the temple, they want to light the menorah. Oh, and then they find the jar of oil and that lasts. Three miracles. But as much as you could tell that story, it's interesting that these three different versions don't seem to really focus on each other that much. Sure, every source has to acknowledge the Hashmonaim were victorious, but the story in the Gemara doesn't really focus on the military victory. It focuses on the oil. Al Hanisim in the Siddur makes no reference to the miracle of the oil. It just says they lit the menorah again. It's striking that these three stories don't seem to have, even though it's so easy to put all three together, they seem to exist on mutually exclusive planes. Traditionally, we don't really link all the stories together. One thing to just know about the military focus, which is something Justice Blackmun notes, he writes, the cultural significance of Hanukkah varies with the setting in which the holiday is celebrated. In contemporary Israel, the nationalist and military aspects of Hanukkah story receive special emphasis, which is as descriptively very true. In Israel, there has become far more of a focus in the recent past on the military aspect of Hanukkah, which makes a lot of sense. When you have a country with an army and you have one festival, one classic festival that celebrates military victory, you're going to go all in on the military emphasis of that. But broadly speaking, Jews, we don't necessarily as easily focus on the military side of Hanukkah. We seem to focus on just one of these miracles. We don't seem to ever focus on all three. We don't seem to ever really celebrate all the different aspects to Hanukkah. And so we're actually left with, and to reframe this slightly, the quintessential question of Hanukkah, which is how the Gemara opens. My Hanukkah. And if you look at source number 6, how does Rashi explain what the Gemara's question is? Al eza neis kva'uha, which miracle is it that we are celebrating? We are assuming that Hanukkah is celebrating a specific miracle, and yet we have a veritable smorgasbord of options. There are a few different miracles we could pick from, and yet the Gemara seems to focus on the miracle of the oil. That's the one that we know. That's the one, you know, you pull a kid with limited fluency in Jewish holidays and you ask them to explain the story of Hanukkah, it's the miracle of oil. You watch the Rugrats Hanukkah special and it's the miracle of the oil. All of these things, that this is what's referenced always. And yet, there is a well-known classic issue with this story of the oil. If you take a look at source number 7, it's from the Gemara in Yoma, which teaches us a wider principle. Tumat hamet hutrahi betzibo. It's talking about if the Kohen Gadol is rendered impure and does that invalidate his service. For our purposes, the key thing here is tuma hutra betzibo. Impurities are permitted. We aren't as precious about them in the case of public need. When there is a public need, when the entire community as a whole will benefit from something, even if we would usually be concerned about whether that thing is pure or impure, when it comes to public need, we don't worry. And now think back to the story of Hanukkah that the Gemara tells. The Hashmonaim arrive in the Beit HaMikdash. And they find tons of jars of oil, absolute storehouses of them. There's one problem. There is only one jar of oil that's pure. And the story assumes that's a problem. But it's not. Who cares if the oil is impure? There was a communal need to light the menorah. Halachically speaking, they could have used any jar of oil. The jar of oil could have had a cockroach in it, definitionally about as impure as it could be, and it doesn't matter because Tumah Hutra Betzibo, we permit impurity in the case of public need. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever that they needed to be careful about only using the one jar of oil that was sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. So this is the question of Hanukkah. That literally books have been written compiling all the different answers to this question. It is about as big a question as you can find in the story of Hanukkah, that from Chazal's own internal logic, from Halacha's own system of thinking, the miracle of oil makes absolutely no sense. There's no reason why they needed a pure jar of oil. They could have used any jar of oil whatsoever. There is a second issue you can raise, whether oil to begin with can be possibly impure, which is a whole, from a halachic standpoint, which is a whole separate question. You can raise a lot of questions about why on earth did the Hashmonaim care about the purity of the oil? So just one example of one answer that's given is by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who was one of the most prominent rabbis in the 20th century. He passed away in 1995. He lived in Israel, one of the most authoritative and well-regarded rabbis of the 20th century. And he raises this question and points out, it cannot therefore be that what we are actually celebrating on Hanukkah is the miracle of the oil. And thus writes in source number 8, Ulafichach, this is his conclusion. Ulafichach nira de ikar hahalal vahauda. The actual main reason why we are singing halal, why we are thanking God, hu al hanes shel hamilchama. It's actually the military victory. Ela de bamilchama atzma afsha hayunisim gedolim. Because when you actually think about it, the war itself would have been made up of multiple miracles. The Chashmonaim winning the battle is actually not one miracle. It's thousands of miracles rolled into one. That time, that platoon of troops wasn't spotted. That time, that other platoon were able to, you know, defeat a military, you know, three times their size. Lots and lots of stacked miracles. Why then do we need to actually light the menorah? Because that gives us something tangible, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I didn't put it on the source. It gives us something tangible to ritualize our celebration, because I'm sure if we thought about it for long enough, we could come up with something. But when you think about it, it is hard to ritualize a military victory. So what instead? We celebrate. We use the lighting of lights, lighting of a menorah, to reference the Beit HaMikdash redeemed, to recognize the Beit HaMikdash once again being used. But actually, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the real reason we are celebrating Hanukkah is the military one. One of the things that is very interesting about this source, when we once again think about the Supreme Court justices, is that, and this is something we'll see slightly more next week, Justice Blackmun is criticized over and over again by the other justices for his, what they believe to be his mental gymnastics in trying to claim the menorah is not just a religious symbol, but also a cultural symbol. But had Justice Blackmun had this source, had he been able to compare Al Hanisim to the miracle of the oil, that would actually give him an opportunity to kind of argue that, well, yes, the menorah is actually the real celebration of Hanukkah is the military victory. And really, the menorah just helps facilitate the celebration of religious freedom that the Jewish people received. When you pivot and you choose a different way of celebrating Hanukkah, when you shift the focus to be on the military victory rather than the miracle of oil, it also shifts the significance of the menorah. Again, we'll talk more about this next week, but you can already start to see how this question impacts the relevance of the menorah. If we're celebrating the oil that lasted 8 nights, lighting particularly oil, but lighting flames for 8 nights has far more power than if we're really celebrating a military victory and we just want to anchor our celebration in some sort of ritual and object. Now, the truth is, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's view finds its root in Rashi himself. Take a look at source number 9. He says, in describing Hanukkah, Lo she'asurim b'malacha, that the days of Hanukkah are not days of Yom Tov, where you are forbidden from doing malacha, that you can't do, you know, the various prohibited activities that we cannot do during Chagim. Ela likrot, shalom nikba'u ela likrot ha'halel, v'loma al hanisim b'hoda'a. No, the real reason for Hanukkah is, he doesn't emphasize the menorah here, he emphasizes saying halal. He emphasizes saying al hanisim. Saying al hanisim obviously far more explicitly references the military victory than the miracle of the oil. And so it seems very clear that the standard understanding we have of what we are celebrating on Hanukkah needs far more levels of complexity than what we think. That as much as we celebrate the miracle of the oil as expressed from Chazal, there seems to be some good reasons to question why that is, first of all, a miracle, And again, lots of wonderful drashot, lots of wonderful ideas explaining it. But second, we seem to diminish often, particularly in America, particularly outside of the land of Israel, and Jews have traditionally diminished the role of the military victory and definitely the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash. So the question becomes, why? How did we get to a state where we emphasize one miracle of Hanukkah over all the others? And here there are a few different answers. One is simply, you can imagine why talking about the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash has little appeal. Even for all of us, let's be honest. Unfortunately, we don't live in a world with a temple, and so we cannot appreciate truly what that means. And so it's hard for us to celebrate the rededication of a temple that we ourselves are unable to experience. It's also very easy to imagine why, for most of Jewish history, the idea of celebrating a military victory would be not the biggest, greatest idea in the world. At a certain point, if you are living in the medieval world, if you are living in a ghetto in Europe, the idea of celebrating the fact that the Jews once overcame their oppressors, it could inspire some people, but it probably is only going to further reinforce how much you've lost. A more overt, explicit miracle like oil lasting for 8 days is a far more simpler idea to wrap one's head around and celebrate. But there is perhaps an even deeper reason. And it's a controversial answer, not in the sense that it's only advanced by people whose views are outside the pale, far from it, as we're about to see, but controversial in the sense that it actually forces us to reframe the entire way we perhaps approach the heroes of the Hanukkah story. Given that we're still a few weeks away, it's perhaps easier to reframe our approach to the heroes of the Hanukkah story, but nonetheless, there's a very simple answer. Chazal did not like the Hashmonaim. They did not like the Hasmoneans and how they achieved their victory. Part of this, and this is a broader conversation for another time, is the Hashmonaim are explicitly zealots. They are extremists. And Chazal, for all that we might think some of their viewpoints kind of fall on the, you know, quote-unquote extreme end of the spectrum, they actually were not the biggest fans of what we would call nowadays in the 21st century fundamentalists. Particularly the Hashmonaim, we have to remember, sadly, they were willing to fight other Jews. It wasn't just the Seleucids who they fought. They also fought the Hellenized Jews. The Jews who, you know, believed they could synthesize Hellenic culture, Greek culture with their Jewish lives, were put to the sword just as much as the Seleucids themselves. And so you can also imagine why Chazal would not look too positively on a group of people who also murdered the Jews, you know, in the course of, you know, their campaign for freedom. And actually, when you look at the sources, Chazal are often very critical of the Hashmonaim. They are very critical of what became of the Hasmonean dynasty. First of all, many, many times there is a cautionary tale of the priesthood should not be the kingship. We'll see a source emphasizing that in a second. But first, take a look at source number 10. So it comes from the Gemara in Yoma, trying to seek to explain why a certain chamber of the Beit HaMikdash was called what it was called. And it says, "Umitoch shenotnin alav mamon lekohuna." During this time, during this bad, bad time in the second Beit HaMikdash, people would buy the high priesthood. "Umachalifen oto kol shneim asar chodesh." And because they were then replaced every 12 months, because people were constantly outbidding them, "Kefar hedrin," just like a parhedrin, which is a title of someone else, hallelujah, shemachlif and otan kol shnei masar chodesh, who are replaced every 12 months, lefichach hayukorin otan lishkat parhedrin, therefore they called this chamber, you know, pejoratively, the chamber of the parhedrin, What's the historical context for this bad, bad moment in Jewish history? As Rashi explains, mitoch she kohanei bayit sheni hayu omdim al yidei mamon shenotnin al gura gedola lemalchei beit chashmonai. Because they were buying it off, but they were giving it to the Hasmoneans, the Chashmonaim. It was the very dynasty that, you know, were victorious in the Hanukkah story, but eventually their descendants and their descendants' descendants, yada, 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 eventually were corrupt. They ran the Beit HaMikdash in incredibly corrupt ways, and for this reason, you know, they allowed the priesthood to be bought. There was outright corruption in the Beit HaMikdash, not very good at all. So one reason why the Chashmonaim were disliked. The second reason, Ramban talks about this, so this is from the verse in Parashat Vayechi, about the scepter shall not depart from Yehuda, the role of kingship shall never leave the tribe of Yehuda. Ramban writes the following, V'zeh haya onesh ha-Chashmonaim, shemalchu b'bayit sheni. This was the punishment of the Hasmoneans who reigned during the Second Temple. Aval called Zera Matityahu Chashmonai Hatzadik Lo Avru. They were only the children of Matityahu. So Matityahu, he describes as Matityahu Chashmonai Hatzadik. Matityahu is righteous. He's the one who starts the rebellion. But his children, why were they punished? They fell. They were deposed. Ela ba'avosha malchu velo hayu mizera Yehuda o mibeit David, because they weren't from the Davidic dynasty. They were Kohanim. They were priests themselves. And the tribe of Levi and the tribe of Yehuda, related, but not the same. This week's parasha, we have the running order of all the various children. Levi and Yehuda are two different children. They are brothers of one another. They are not the same person. V'hisiru hashevet v'hamachokek legamrei. They weren't part of the tribe of Yehuda. What they're doing is they're removing the scepter that Yaakov prophesies will never be removed. And they're taking away the lawgiver status. V'haya onsham mida k'neged mida. And therefore they were punished. Shaham shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu aleihem et avdeihem v'him hakritum. So God made it so that eventually, and I don't want to get into the sad end that Chazal talk about with what happened to the Chashmonai dynasty, but as Ramban alludes to, they ended up being ruled by slaves themselves because they usurped the throne. They had no right to the throne. In the end, what happened was those who had no right to their throne took it from them. So again, there's another reason why you would want to diminish the role of the Chashmonaim, the military victory. The reason you wouldn't want to hold up the Chashmonaim as heroes is because, especially by the era of Chazal, they're not good guys. They're not people to celebrate. They are people we no longer look on as positively to the same degree. And there is perhaps an even stronger source that points to why Chazal would have disliked celebrating the military victory. Take a look at this Mishnah in Masechet Shabbat. I will admit that it is a very unpopular Mishnah to share with Americans, but nonetheless, here we go. Lo yetze ha'ish lo v'sayif. A person may not go out on Shabbat with a sword, v'lo v'keshet, nor with a bow, v'lo v'tris, nor with a shield, v'lo v'alan, nor with a lance, v'lo v'romach, nor with a spear. You can't go out with a weapon. V'im yatza, and if you do, chayav chatat, you are liable, you have violated Shabbat. Rabbi Eliezer, omer tachshiten ein lo. Rabbi Eliezer says, what are you talking about? It's an ornament. If you go out with some sort of ornament on you, let's say you had a nice necklace, I don't know, and you're wearing it ornamentally, there's no problem there. The Chachamim Omrim, the sages, however, responded, Einan ela lignai. No, these objects, these weapons, are nothing other than reprehensible. Shne Emar, as it says, and then it's the famous verse from Sefer Yeshayahu, they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, yada, yada, yada. In other words, in the times of Mashiach, there will be no weapons. How can you claim weapons are good? a very famous and fascinating Mishnah. Don't want to explore all of its corollaries right now. But what you can clearly see are the same Chachamim who declared that weapons are lignai. You can see why they wouldn't want to celebrate the Chashmonaim too much. Nowadays, and I should stress this is a good thing, but nowadays we celebrate, and in the land of Israel particularly, we can latch onto the idea that Hanukkah is a time to celebrate a military victory. But Chazal, who did not have an Israeli army to be proud of, and Chazal, who lived in their own world, were not fans of weapons. They were not fans of warmongers. They were not fans of, you know, warriors. And so when they come to the story of Hanukkah, and I'm going to scroll back up to source number two, and they ask, my Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? They have a choice. They can talk about the obvious, the military victory, but they don't. Why would they? Why would they celebrate this group of people who are the bad guys doing something, they who are the bad guys nowadays, not in the times of the Hanukkah story, I should stress, but who, you know, who were the bad guys in the more recent past of Jewish history? Why would they celebrate their military victory doing something Chazal didn't really like to begin with? And so what Chazal do instead is they focus on the other miracle. The miracle that's kind of not a miracle when you think about it. It's an amazing miracle, but basically they found only one jar of oil that they didn't need to use, but they were like, oh, let's go for it. Let's just use this one. We'll start off doing the right thing. And it happened to last for 8 days. Again, lots of amazing drashot to talk about. Maybe I will even share one of them in the run-up to Hanukkah. But when you think about the miracles, if you order them, you have the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash, which is an incredible reason to celebrate Hanukkah. But whether you are Chazal living in, you know, 400s CE in Babylon, or your Jews living in 21st century world, whether it's Israel or America, where there's no Beit HaMikdash, there's a limit to the significance of instituting a holiday that celebrates Jewish access to something you no longer have access to. You could celebrate the, and I forgot if I already talked about the military victory in this little bit of it, because I just got so distracted for a second, but there you go. But you could celebrate the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash. The next most sensible thing to celebrate is the military victory, because that is a tremendous miracle, as Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach says. Actually, multiple miracles all stacked together. But there's a problem there too, because you are venerating the Chashmonaim. And if you're a member of Chazal, you don't want to. They were, in their day, they were associated with corruption. They were associated with, you know, not being appropriate fit kings, doing something, murdering their fellow Jews, doing things in general that Chazal didn't really approve of. So you're left with another miracle, which is the one miracle that, yeah, had that oil burned out after one night, they could have just picked up the jar with the cockroach and they could have lit that oil instead. And it would have been fine. But it was a miracle, an amazing miracle. I don't want to sound like I'm diminishing the miracle of the oil, because I'm not. But it was a miracle, but it didn't have to be. But we end up turning it into this major thing because the other two we don't like as much. And so the classic answer to my Hanukkah is actually far more complicated than we think. What we are actually celebrating on Hanukkah are three different interrelated miracles that all stack on top of one another. And yet the miracle we celebrate chief among them in some ways tells us more about the people who told us to celebrate Hanukkah Chazal than it does about the Hanukkah story itself. And that is something that we would not expect a Supreme Court justice to grapple with. We would not expect a Supreme Court justice to understand. But it is nonetheless very important for all of us, because when we read, when we come across something like a Supreme Court justice in the U.S., describing the story of Hanukkah, and we're like, oh, this is so amazing, this is so cool. But we should realize as serious Jews who are committed to the complexity of our religion, that it will never be enough. That whatever we see described within these passages here don't actually capture the full story, however popular that story may be. And we actually need to understand a deeper level of the Hanukkah story, which involves all of these various miracles. But what we will begin to talk about, what we will talk about next week, is a related question, which we kind of already touched on. But what is the purpose of the menorah? You can already see part of where we're going. You can already see part of why that's now a question. If we're celebrating the miracle of the oil, the menorah makes a lot more sense than if we're celebrating a military victory. And so the purpose of the menorah, its meaning, what we'll see next week is that the Supreme Court justices had a lot of fascinating debate around this question, but more importantly, so does a lot of halachic literature, and that will hopefully enrich our appreciation of the mitzvah of Neirat Chanukah, of lighting Chanukah candles.